He was a professional thief. His name stirred fear in the hearts of men like a desert wind would stir the tumbleweeds. The most rugged of frontiersmen were frightened, scared of him. For 13 years, starting in 1875, and for the next 13 years, this individual held up 29 stagecoaches in the Wells Fargo company successfully. And the amazing thing is, he did so without ever firing a single shot. His weapons were fear and intimidation. For you see, when he would ride up to a Wells Fargo stagecoach, the driver would look down and see this man on his horse, a man whose identity physically was never described, for his face was covered entirely by a black hood. Thus, in newspapers and journals from San Francisco across country to New York City, his fame spread like wildfire. He was called Black Bart. One of the most notorious banditos of all time, terrorizing the West, haunting the bravest. This man, Black Bart, in Black Hood, reminds me of another one who is terrorizing and haunting our society, not just our country, but all of humanity globally. Jesus called this man a thief and a robber and a liar and a murderer. His weapons, like Black Bart, consist of fear and intimidation, specifically the fear of death. Listen to what Hebrews says. It says concerning this fear that this one, who through fear of death put all throughout their lives subject unto bondage. This one kept all throughout their lives subject unto bondage, and that bondage being the fear of death. Death. Something we don't like to talk about, something we don't like to think on, but something which every one of us deals with constantly. Death. It is reality. Why, in other cultures, they have a tendency to face it more head-on. In China, for example, in a northern province there in China, when you retire from the government, they give a retirement party for their going workers, their leaving workers, and the present they give is not a gold watch or not customized golf clubs, but something much more practical, much more utilitarian, a customized coffin. That's what they give those that are retiring. Here is your retirement present, a customized coffin. It's something everybody can use. Because the statistics on death, as you know, are absolutely incredible. 10 out of 10 people die. And this fear of death haunts and taunts people all of their lives. Now, it might not be just the fear of death physically. It might be, is my marriage going to die? Is my business going to go under? Fear of death vocationally, or is my bank account not going to hold out financially? The fear of death can haunt a person. Something dying. Oh, this person seems so wonderful. Is the relationship going to work out and develop, or is it doomed to die? And fear fills the hearts of people. And this Black Bart spiritually, identified in the scriptures as the devil, Satan, comes and intimidates people constantly with the fear of death and holds them in that bondage all of their lives. Now, listen to what this writer goes on to say in the book of Hebrews concerning Jesus. For as much then as children are partakers of flesh and blood, Jesus also himself likewise took part of the same. That is, he became flesh and blood. That through death he might destroy him that has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Jesus. He saw what we were going through. The intimidation that we were under, the fear that we were feeling, and he became just like you, just like me. Jesus, our hero, became just like us and walked in the midst of us and then died for us that in so doing, he might destroy the one who had the power of death, who kept people in bondage of the fear of death all of their lifetime. Jesus came to meet death head on and to do in that black Bart that we might be set free. In our text, we see this encounter. Jesus and death meeting face to face. Now, please note, this encounter is not accidental, but it's oh so intentional. A lot of times, encounters are accidental. I came across an article in the Chronicle yesterday that intrigued me. Speaking of accidental encounters, Blacksburg, Virginia. Sheriff's deputies rushed into a home with guns drawn in response to a series of 911 calls. But they found they had been summoned by a tomato. Authorities became interested when a Montgomery County dispatcher traced repeated emergency calls to the home of Linda and Danny Hurst. Now, the Hursts were not home, so police figured someone might have broken in. Deputies went in with guns drawn and found the house empty. Then Danny Hurst, who had been called to the scene, found an overripe tomato in a hanging basket dripping juice onto a telephone answering machine below. Police figured it. The juice from the distressed tomato short-circuited the machine's dialing system, causing it to call the sheriff's department emergency line that was pre-recorded in that machine. Said Montgomery County Chief Deputy Milton Graham, "The tomato, it just burst. Then it called us." I guess it needed help or needed cleaning up. Sometimes encounters are accidental. A tomato bursting, the police coming. Why is all this happening? But not so with Jesus. Jesus' encounters were all very intentional. And I point this out because here we see in our text, Jesus going 25 miles out of his way, leaving Capernaum where he had been teaching previously and working miracles powerfully. Now he goes to a little hick town called Nain. 25 miles out of his way, and yet there was an encounter awaiting him. Not accidentally, but very intentionally. We read in verse 11 of chapter 7 of Luke. It came to pass the day after his teaching, his miracle working, that Jesus went into a city called Nain. And many of his disciples went with him, and much people. Now, when he came nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and much people of the city was with her. Catch the scene. Jesus going into Nain. A group coming out from Nain. Two groups interacting, two groups encountering, one group going into the city rejoicing, the other group walking out from the city weeping. The group going into the city was rejoicing because they were traveling with Jesus Christ. They had been taking in his teachings, they had been watching his miracle workings, and they were rejoicing. The group that was coming out from the city was weeping, knowing nothing about Jesus Christ. One group going into the city, the other group going out to the cemetery. And I suggest to you today that every single one of us sitting in this sanctuary is in one of those two crowds right now. Either we are traveling with Jesus to the city, or we are going out to the nursery. Thank you. We are either with Jesus going into that city. What city? Paul declared this. Abraham looked for that city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. A city that was solid and real, satisfying and eternal. Abraham knew that it wasn't here. He knew that it wasn't going to be found in Mesopotamia. It wasn't in Babylon or Baghdad or New York or Medford or White City. It would be found nowhere on this globe. No, he knew that it was a city he longed for that would be found only in eternity. He moved towards that city. And those too say, yes, with Abraham, we are traveling in faith towards that city, towards heaven. We too will be rejoicing. You see, when you realize it's not here, the pressure is off. When you realize you're headed towards heaven, suddenly the fears and frustrations of this world diminish in exact proportion to the focus that you have on things that are eternal. Picture with me, suppose for a moment, you were involved in ice skating competition. And you go through your preliminaries, and you go through all of the mandatories, and now you're headed for stage 3. The open skate in front of thousands of people who have jammed the arena to watch your presentation, to see your creativity, your agility. And right before you're ready to go out on the ice in front of all those folks, in the final phase of the competition, your coach comes up to you and says, "Hey, the judges, we've tallied the scores, and because of your preliminary scores, your mandatory scores, you've already won. No matter what you do out there on the ice, you are so far ahead of the competition, even if you get zip zero, you win." Now, if the coach told me that, wow, I go, great. And you go out on the ice and say, "Hey, this is a kick. I'll try an aerial or a double axel or whatever it might be. Who cares? I've already won. So I can be daring and creative. And if I fall down, I can laugh it off because the gold medal's already mine." Jesus said, "Don't let your hearts be troubled. In my Father's house are many mansions. I'm going to prepare a place for you. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going to prepare a place for you that where I am, there ye may be also. So don't let your heart be troubled." See, life becomes really joyful, really interesting when you're not living for this world. You can go out and skate on through and try some aerials and do whatever because you know that you are headed towards that city. Not so with people who don't know the Lord traveling in the crowd towards the cemetery. They're in bondage. I don't care how popular, how powerful, how many possessions they might have. They are in bondage. Popularity. There was a man not too many years ago who claimed to be the most popular person in world history. He claimed to be even more popular than Jesus Christ. His name, John Lennon. And a case could be made as far as the number of people who heard him. Tremendous amounts of people around the globe heard him or knew about him. But of course, his statement was blasphemous. A popular person, he was an icon for our generation. But when you read his book or a book about him, A Hard Day's Life, you see that the end of his story was an unmitigated tragedy. He was so afraid of being left alone, so afraid that death would stalk up on him, he would never allow a single light in his house to be turned off all night long. He slept with every light on in his house for fear that something sinister would creep up and get him. He became, in his last years, like many others who go through such fears do, he became one obsessed with cleanliness, taking 18 to 20 showers a day, washing and scrubbing his hands constantly for fear that some germ would attach itself to him and he would then experience his own mortality. He was a mess mentally. Popular, perhaps, but free, no way. Bondage to the fear of death. Power. One of the most powerful men in the history, at least recent history, was a man named Joseph Stalin. Ruled with an iron fist the entire Soviet Union, killing perhaps 20 million of his own citizens because they would dare to go against him or not pledge their allegiance to him. He was powerful, but was he secure? 7 bedrooms in his home, in his residence, he would not tell even his closest advisors or servants what room he would use that night to sleep in alone. He was afraid to death that someone would sneak in and do him in. 14 or 15 cars with chauffeurs were at his disposal at any given moment, and he would never in advance say which car was to be used to keep his would-be attackers off guard. And Stalin had a man whose sole job was singularly to carry with him Joseph Stalin's tea bags. And before Stalin ever sipped his tea that he was fond of, this man would first inspect the bags, dip in water, and take a drink himself, lest someone slip some poison in his tea. Powerful? Sure. Free? Absolutely not. He was in fear, in the bondage of the fear of death. How about possessions? Maybe the richest man in our generation, a man who had so much money, it's really uncountable, incalculable. For the past, or the last, I should say, 12 years of his life, lived without coming out, without being seen, in a room of a motel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Howard Hughes. Another one obsessed with cleanliness. Another one terrorized the fear of death. Finally, in his last months, they snuck him out of his hotel room. He hadn't been seen in years. Snuck him out in a large refrigerator box. They took him down to Baja, Mexico, where he spent his last months in the wildest, remotest region of Baja, California, hoping that he would not be polluted or infected with anything that would bring about his demise. And so his beard grew past his belly. His fingernails became like corkscrews, claws, really. And he died in misery. Because he was not in the crowd going into that city with Jesus Christ rejoicing. But he, like Stalin, like Lenin, like the people that live next door to you and to me, was in the other crowd headed towards the cemetery. Two crowds. Every one of us right now is in one of those crowds. Rejoicing, traveling to that city, or sorrowing as we travel towards the cemetery. Gang, it's not true what Clairol is telling you. Clairol is saying, you're not getting older, you're getting better. That's not true. All you have to do is look in the mirror, and you'll see another lie of Madison Avenue, who lies to you and lies to me constantly, saying, if we just get this or have that, we'll be happy. So we buy the Pontiac, or the Oldsmobile, the latest model. We saw it on TV, driving with a clean car, there at the beach, palm trees and parties, and we get the car, but where's the beach? We make the payments, but where's the party? I mean, where are all the people that are happy and youthful and zestful? We have the right car, but, where are they? Tricked again. It's a lie. It's a lie being pushed at you constantly by this world system that, hey, possessions or popularity or power will bring you security. No way. Not true. Those who experience those things to the highest degree are most aware of the terror that's within them. Being in bondage of the fear of death all the days of their life. Now, notice, not only two crowds. But in this interesting encounter, we see not only two crowds, one going into the city rejoicing, the other going towards the cemetery weeping. But notice, two only sons have an encounter. For we see in verse 12 that this dead man was actually a young man, the only son of his mother. She was a widow, and much people of the city were with her. A widow in that society was left vulnerable, exposed. There was no social security, no welfare net to protect her financially. Having lost her husband and now her only son, she would be vulnerable, uncovered, in danger financially, economically, even in some ways socially. Her son is dead. Her only son is dead. Now notice, as her only son who was alive, now dead. That only son, now dead, was destined to live. Because another only son came who was then living but destined to die. Jesus Christ. God's only son comes and sees that only son in the bier, in the coffin, if you would. And God's only son was definitely alive, but he knew why he came. He was destined to die. By the way, when you talk philosophically with other religious thinkers or pop philosophers, remind them of that truth. If you're talking about Buddha or Confucius or Muhammad or Bhagwan or whoever you want to talk about, any religious leader or philosopher or so-called thinker, in every case, death interrupted their mission without exception. Death interrupted their mission. They could no longer share their pearls of wisdom or their esoteric insights. Death interrupted their mission. But with Jesus, uniquely, death was his mission. He came to die. Wait a minute. In a very real sense, he was dead before he lived. For the Bible says in Revelation that he was the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world. Slain in eternity past, then entering into the time-space continuum that we now live in, wrapped in swaddling clothes as the babe of Bethlehem, taking upon the appearance of a mummy, if you would, burial clothes in reality, because he came for the purpose of dying. Why? That we who were dead might live. He became sin for you and for me. God's only Son, alive but destined to die, is now encounter this woman's only Son who is dead but destined to live. Watch what happens. When the Lord saw her, he had compassion upon her, and he said, "Weep not." We now see the third interesting encounter. Not only two crowds, two only sons, but two sufferers. Jesus, Isaiah says, is the man of sorrow. I find that very intriguing because Jesus had such a personality and warmth and vibrancy that people rallied around him, loved to be with him. They accused him, his enemies, of being too into life. A glutton, a winebibber. Why isn't he like the Pharisees? Why isn't he like John the Baptist, more ascetic? Why doesn't he show misery? But Jesus modeled what he promised to you and to me. I have come that you might have life and life abundantly. And there was an abundance and an exuberance around him, about him, that drew people to him. Still does. At the same time, he is and always will be the man of sorrows. Why? Because of this word, he looked and had compassion on this one who was weeping. The man of sorrows met the mother who was sorrowing. The man of sorrows met the woman who was sorrowing. And compassion, listen, compassion means this. Taking someone else's pain into your heart. That's what compassion is. That's what Jesus does. Only Jesus. Looking upon the hurts of anyone in this room and not condemning you for those hurts or wondering about those hurts, but relating to those hurts. Taking your pain in his heart. He is therefore the man of sorrows. Not because he was bummed and blue and depressed, but because he absorbed the hurts of those around him. He had compassion upon her, the man of sorrows, upon the woman who was sorrowing, and he said to her, "Weep not. Weep not." He knew what he was about to do. He came, verse 14, and he touched the bier. That is sort of a wicker kind of basket that they would use to transport their dead in those days. He came and touched the bier, and they that bore that bier stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." Check this out. And he that was dead sat up and began to speak. And he delivered him to his mother. And there came a fear upon all. And they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet is risen up among us. And God has visited his people." And this rumor of him went forth throughout all Judea, throughout all the region round about. Heavy. He's alive. Speaking and talking to the mother who loved him and depended on him and greatly missed him. "Young man, arise." Boing. And he began talking to his mother. discoursing, dialoguing. I cannot help but think of these words of Paul the Apostle. Listen while I read to you. I would not have you ignorant, brother, concerning them which are asleep, that you sorrow not, even as others do which have no hope. For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and even so he will bring them which sleep with him. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain at the coming of the Lord shall not prevent them which are asleep, dead. The Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the air to meet the Lord in the clouds, and so shall we be ever with the Lord. Comfort one another with these words. That's what Jesus does. Not just then in Mark 7, but for every one of us, he says, weep not, arise, come up. And there is going to be a reuniting and a fulfilling and a satisfying when we are with those who have gone before us. More importantly, when we are face to face with our hero and love, the Lord Jesus, and we move into heaven, the place that he's prepared for us, we're going to say, excellent, bodacious, wonderful, perfect, primo, whatever adjective you want to use. Lord, this is it. And Jesus says to us, weep not. That resurrecting, that reuniting, that fulfilling is coming. And if you will live in that hope, this life will not get you down. You will not be caught up with this life or absorbed by this life, but rather you will be free from the fear of death, which keeps people in bondage all of their days. You're free. So if the business dies, so if the relationship doesn't work out, ultimately that's not the issue. The issue is, where am I going to spend eternity in? I'm going to that city with that great company of those who are traveling with Jesus Christ. Gang, listen carefully. The process of death is indeed and can be painful. Just like the process of birth is indeed and can be painful. We guys know all about that. Did you know it was never intended to be that way? Did you know God's intention in the birthing process was that it would be painless? But because of the sin of Eve and Adam in the Garden of Eden, pain in the birthing process was part of the repercussions, the price of that sin. So when a person is being birthed from the belly, from the womb of the mother, there is a pain involved and a sorrow. But who of us in this sanctuary would wish to pipe our voice in to that babe still encased in mama and say, oh, don't come out. Stay there, man. It's painful. Your skull gets crushed and contractions squeeze you and fluid covers you and it's brutal. Stay there forever. I don't think one of us would tell a babe still in mama to stay there. Because you know what? Not a one of you even remembers the pain that you went through when you were born. And you did hurt. Your skull did collapse. Some have yet to be restored. The process is painful. That's part of the curse, part of the fall. But then all of a sudden, wow, there's a whole new life. There is waves to surf and mountains to ski. There is people to meet and things to learn. And man, it's a whole new dimension that's much greater
than the darkness and tightness of the mother. So too, death was never meant to hurt, never meant to be. The model was Jesus in Matthew 17 when he went up to Mount Hermon, was transfigured after he lived 33 years. He began to glow. That, I believe, was God's intention. That after man had passed the test on earth, he would just be transfigured and brought right up into heaven. No death. Just a glowing. A victoring. But man sinned. Thus, part of the repercussion of sin is that now our moving into eternity, like being birthed into this world presently, it is painful. You watch somebody go through cancer and your heart breaks. Somebody suffer prematurely or go through pain and agony and you go, oh, oh. But the people who are in heaven are not saying, stay there on earth. They're saying, get out of there, man. Come up hither. There's a whole new dimension that is more radical in comparison from this world and the womb of the mother. This world and heaven, the difference is yet still greater. Joy unspeakable and full of great glory. Eyes have not seen and ears have not heard the wonderful things that God has prepared for those who love Him. He is moving us towards that city. Yes, the birthing into eternity can be painful because of sin. But just like we have forgotten the pain of our own birth, so in heaven, that will not even be a memory. When you arrive, you'll go, hey, this is happening. Gang, on this Thanksgiving week, I don't really care how deep is your theology or how perfected is your praise musically. What I desire in my heart and for you is a continual reflecting on and thanksgiving for the fact that we're saved and going to heaven. We are going to heaven. See, that's the good news. The issue is not anything really but that. The kingdom. Heaven. We're pilgrims and strangers and sojourners here. So Paul the Apostle says, set not your hearts on the things of this world, but set your hearts on things above. Jesus said, don't lay your treasure here, but send it ahead. Heaven. And even if the Lord never answers another of my prayers, even if I never have another feeling of warmth, even if I never gain another insight from His Word, that's not the issue. The bottom line is, we are a saved people, have been freed from the fear of what is beyond. I don't have to keep my lights on at night. I don't have to have Peter John check my tea bags in the morning. I don't have to wash my hands obsessively. I don't have to wonder who's after me or what is ahead of me. I know where I'm going. I'm headed to heaven. And because of that simple fact, Jesus touching this man and saying, arise, John. I'm free. So are you. Totally. By the way, let me finish that story and then we're done. After 13 years, they finally, a group of U.S. Marshals, surrounded Black Bart and apprehended him. One of those men in that group of marshals reached over to where Bart was standing and grabbed that black hood and ripped it off his head. He was not the desperado from Death Valley, as legend had it. He was a frail-bodied, weak, squeaky-voiced, mild-mannered druggist from Decatur, Illinois. And the reason he never fired a shot is because he never had a bullet. His only weapon was fear and intimidation. Satan has been defeated on the cross of Calvary and death has been destroyed. So Paul says, "Oh, death, where is thy sting? Oh, grave, where is thy victory?" It's over. We're free. And now, all that's left for you and for me is to say, I don't care what intimidation or fears that Satan whispers in my ear. He's been exposed and defeated and done in. How? My hope is in Jesus Christ, who is taking me to heaven. So rejoice, precious people, and celebrate the fact of your salvation. Let's pray, shall we? We have come to understand, Lord, that the secret of transformation is observation. Seeing you, you tell us, we become like you. Jesus, we see you in this vignette, in this story, freeing her from her sorrowing, from her fear, and raising him back to life victoriously. And I thank you that you have done so for me, for us, that we know where we're going, that we can celebrate this life knowing that it's not here. I would pray for any right now, Lord, who know you, who are presently being intimidated by that one who has no bullet. Any who are being filled with fears about death, that they might see you, Jesus, and sense your touch and hear your voice. Arise. May faith well up within them. May hope be returned to them. And may we as a congregation, Lord, really live with our hearts and minds fixed on heaven. On you, Jesus. If any in here don't know you, Lord, who are still traveling in that company, going in the opposite direction of the city, Lord, before they get to that cemetery, may they change their course and join us. May they receive you and be saved. May this be the moment of salvation, Lord. Now, Jesus, bring us back to the profound simplicities of what life is about, that we might reorder our priorities, walk with you joyfully. Jesus, we choose to join you again right now in that procession of many people headed towards that city that has foundations. We embrace you and love you and follow you and will be forever grateful to you, Jesus, for you have freed us from such fear. And we love you. We really do.